From the McGrath Institute for Church Life and OSV Podcast, this is Church Life Today. I'm Leonard DiLorenzo. I do not think that all who choose wrong roads perish, but their rescue consists in being put back on the right road. A sum can be put right, but only by going back till you find the error and working it afresh from that point, never simply by going on. Evil can be undone, but it cannot develop into good. Time does not heal it. The spell must be unwound bit by bit with backward mutters of dissevering power, or else not. It is still either or. If we insist on keeping hell or even earth, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs of hell. I believe, to be sure, that any man who reaches heaven will find that what he abandoned, even in plucking out his right eye, has not been lost, that the kernel of what he was really seeking, even in his most depraved wishes, will be there, beyond expectation, waiting for him in the high countries. In that sense, it will be true for those who have completed the journey, and for no others, to say that good is everything and heaven everywhere. But we, at this end of the road, must not try to anticipate that retrospective vision. If we do, we are likely to embrace the false and disastrous converse and fancy that everything is good and everywhere is heaven. But what, you ask, of earth? Earth, I think, will not be found by anyone to be, in the end, a very distinct place. I think earth, if chosen instead of heaven, will turn out to have been, all along, only a region in hell. And earth, if put second to heaven, to have been, from the beginning, a part of heaven itself. That reading is taken from the preface of C.S. Lewis' The Great Divorce, written, of course, in his own pen there. This is before the narrative begins in this little book, The Great Divorce, but there he's giving us, in some ways, the basic idea behind this little masterpiece that he constructed of only, 120, 130 pages or so. Recently, I was thinking about this book in the middle of Lent as we approach Easter and thinking how appropriate it is to read this, especially in liturgical time, moving from Lent to Easter with its emphasis on purgation for the sake of greater glory and the fullness of joy. So I thought, why don't we do an episode on that for Church Life Today and just spend some time with this great little book, The Great Divorce. And it turns out that I'm not going to do this by myself because I cannot get my friend and colleague, Josh McManaway, out of our podcasting studio. Here he is again. Josh. That's right. How you doing?
Yeah, you can't get rid of me. Any topic, I just want to show up and chat with you about it. So here we go.
Hogging the microphone. That's right. So we did a couple of episodes on your developing work on the Creed, which were just recently released. And at the end of, I think, that second episode, I started to bring up The Great Divorce. And you're like, I want to jump on that too. So here you are. Glad you're here. Nice to have you back. We're going to talk about this book, some of the things that each of us admires and likes in the book, get into maybe some different scenes and things like that. But maybe I should ask you this to begin with, and I can say something about it too, but why this book? Like this, when I mentioned it, you're like, oh, I love The Great Divorce. I got to do it. Like, what do you love about this book?
Yeah, I am a big fan of C.S. Lewis in general. I've read many biographies on him. Mm-hmm. I just find him to be a really fascinating character. You know, he was an Oxford Don. He has this major conversion to Christianity a bit later in life. He was friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, the guy who wrote Lord of the Rings. So in general, I really like Lewis, but The Great Divorce, I think, is a profoundly beautiful meditation on the nature of joy, on the nature of love, and it's so thoroughly Augustinian. And mm-hmm. as somebody who works on the early church, it's like, this is my book. You know, in terms of Lewis's oeuvre, you know, it's really something I can see so many resonances from Augustine and other thinkers in this book.
Yeah, I like it because I can read it in its original language, yes. Being an Augustine scholar. I think this is actually, for me, the first book by Lewis that I read. I was thinking back to this, and I didn't reading Lewis till much later in life. I think I was already an undergraduate in college, and it was in a class with Father Brian Daly, who you know.
Who knew Lewis?
He did?
Yeah, he knew him when he studied at Oxford.
You know what they say about Brian Daly? He didn't join the Jesuits. The Jesuits joined him. That's right. I didn't know that. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was a kind of like an introductory theology course on eschatology. And this was just one of the texts in there. And it just caught me right away. And I think it was the kind of image that Lewis can build for us in this book. And much of that image has to do with the terrain. And this, I think, being my, I think it was my introduction to Lewis. That's one of the things that has sustained in my love for him is his ability to convey images, to tell stories through images, and to bring you into imaginative places.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, I think that's the case for children who have come across the Chronicles of Narnia and adults who return to it. Like, you see the thing and you're there in it with him and his ability to do that. And I encountered that first here with The Great Divorce. So I guess as we get started talking about this book, maybe we should spend time with that very thing, like the actual landscape that he is portraying for us. And really, there are two different realms in this book, one just very much at the beginning, and then the second through a point of transition in the latter parts of the book. The first is this gray town, which is more or less identified with hell, and the second is the bright and expansive land that's more identified with heaven. So, Josh, you want to... why don't you break open hell for us, if you will?
Sure. Yeah, it seems fitting.
Yeah.
It's interesting because a kind of traditional, or at least one of the traditional ways of thinking about hell is like the man in chapter 7 says, you know, people sizzling on grates and demons with pitchforks. And, you know, at least it would be interesting to look at. I mean, there's a lot going on. That's kind of a spectacle. But Lewis goes another way in his description of the gray town, which is a kind of desolate, empty, but really, really vast landscape.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm reminded of that quip by Sartre, you know, that hell is other people. But for Lewis, it's the exact opposite. Hell is yourself alone, you know? And so the book opens with the narrator saying, you know, that he hadn't seen anybody until he got to this bus stop at the beginning of the story. And as he learns more and more about the land, it turns out that what hell is this ever sprawling city where quarrelsome people who can't get along continue to move further and further out from the center of the land. And that you can have a house just by thinking, you know, oh, I'd like a house here, but it's not a substantial house, right? Everything in the gray town is a kind of simulacrum. You know, it does okay for the moment, but it's not something that anyone should want permanently. And the impermanence of hell, I think, is supposed to kind of spurn you on towards something greater. And that something greater, you know, arises, I think, as they hopefully get on the bus. And then they go to this bright land. So it seems fitting that you should describe the bright land.
How about if I got hell? The bright land. Yes. One of the lines that I absolutely love in this book, there's so many good lines, and this is another thing that Lewis does, right? He creates images, but then he also captures so much in these brief lines. But one is that reality is harsh to the feet of shadows.
Yes.
And this is a way to speak about that transition from the gray town to the real land, the bright and expansive country now in another way.
That's right.
Which is that this is reality itself. And when these ghostly figures who have transcended out of the gray town by this bus arrive in the real land is more real than they themselves are.
Yeah.
They are like figments. They're almost vapors. And the grass is harsh to their feet. The grass is harder than their flesh is. And the water is so substantial that he can walk across it, even though it's still moving. And you can't even pick up a leaf because of the way he says, you know, at one point, I might have just barely budged the leaf, but I couldn't. It was like it's a sack of coal. I couldn't hold it. And there's this hilarious scene later on, this one guy who from the gray town has this scheme of like bringing things back to the gray town to build up a little economy. He's actually got an insight like, there's nothing in this gray town that brings people together. So if I had an actual commodity that people wanted, they would gather around it and a neighborhood would develop. We'd have a little economy and I would turn a profit. And so he goes there to gather apples. And first he's trying to gather a sack. He can't gather a sack. He tries to gather, you know, just two pot. Can't do two pot. Tried to gather the biggest one he can find. Can't carry the biggest one. He eventually barely carries just like one little apple. And this is kind of the image that Lewis gets of the difference between those who have become accustomed to the gray town and those who must become accustomed to this real land. It is vivid and bright, and there is elevation that you are meant to take on, and you yourself have to be thickened to this place. You have to change because that's real. and you are not yet real enough. And that's kind of this brilliant insight that Lewis is bringing into this. And he says, I think again in the preface that, you know, something that shaped his imagination on this, he read this article on this science fiction magazine at some point, and he doesn't remember the author, but if the author comes across his book, please know that he gives his thanks. Anyways, he says, the idea in that story was that it had to do with time travel, and this man goes back in time. And what he finds when he goes back in time is that everything is so dense that it is heavy to him. The raindrops are like bullets, right? And that's because the past is immovable. It's fixed, right? And Lewis, not speaking of time travel here, he's saying, no, that is an image of what real reality is. And that's that is, if we were truly to imagine this in biblical terms, what the disclosure of heaven is. It is the confrontation and the accommodation to the real that we have to get used to.
That's right.
Yeah, that gives us the gray town and the real land here.
Right. Yeah, and they are kind of these the gray town is a parody of the bright land. You know, the spirits come down from the mountain to meet these ghosts on the plain, and you get the idea that kind of further up and further in.
Yes.
You know, right, to quote another one. And so the idea is that the spirits all kind of converge in some kind of unity in God. But in the gray town, they spread ever further apart, you know, such that Napoleon is millions of miles away. And a guy that C.S. Lewis meets on the bus in the story says, yeah, that my house is just up on a little hill and I can kind of see, you know. And so you get the idea that hell is actually this like really flat. I mean, it sounds like Indiana almost, unfortunately.
a little too close to home there, Josh. Good grief.
But, you know, it's very flat and you can just stand on a small hill and see Napoleon pacing about blaming everyone for his downfalls, right? So, but the flatness is not really the point. It's that people go out from the center, whereas in the bright land in heaven, everyone converges together on the mountain.
Yeah. The idea there, you know, in hell is that it's like the tyranny of private preference, right?
Yes.
Like what if you could get what you wanted right when you wanted it all the time?
Yes.
Which sounds heavenly.
Yeah, exactly.
But in fact, Lewis is saying, no, this is hell, because the moment, and I think you said this earlier, the moment that you want to live somewhere else because you don't like your neighbor, you know, there's conflict with neighbor. You have to accommodate. You have to like find common ground. You have to change your way of doing things so you can live next to each other. But in the great town, you don't actually have to do that. You can just, now I have the desire to live away from this person. And this is what's happening all the time.
That's right.
Right? So you're trapped in your own little skull-sized kingdom, moving further and further and further away from other people. And he's giving us this as the image of hell. You brought up this scene with Napoleon. I'm going to read this part, but a couple of these gray figures went on this like sort of unholy pilgrimage out like far, far, far away to see if they could find one of the great figures of history who's kind of locked into his own narrative. And Genghis Khan is too far away and people like that. But Napoleon, he's like one of the nearest of the great figures because there hasn't been that much time. And they eventually get to him, and what they see, they look into this little house that he has, and it says walking up and down all the time, left, right, never stopping for a moment. The two chaps watched him for about a year and he never rested and muttering to himself all the time. It was Sue's fault. It was Ney's fault. It was Josephine's fault. It was the fault of the Russians. It was the fault of the English. Like that all the time. Never stopped for a moment. A little fat man, and he looked kind of tired, but he didn't seem able to stop it. This seems like another little comment on what hell is. So it is, you know, being tied to your own private preference, moving away from others. But here, Napoleon, this little glimpse we get of him, he's locked into one narrative forever. He can't break out of it. He won't break out of it. The same narrative playing over and over again.
Yeah. And so many of the ghosts that we encounter seem pretty one note. And this is not, of course, because Lewis is a bad writer or something like that, but he wants you to zero in on how sin reduces the human person. You know, substantially they are ghosts, but reduces their personalities such that they become known as kind of one thing, and they just bang on about this one thing for eternity.
It is a way also of thinking about, I think something I've heard elsewhere, having to do with the meaning of forgiveness and repentance, then, about, you know, being confined to this one narrative, that forgiveness, among other things, is granting to another the permission to have a new chapter, right? Yeah. To break them out of, to play your part in breaking them out of this one narrative that has enveloped them in some significant way. Yeah. And when you grant forgiveness, you're doing that for someone, and perhaps also for yourself by forgiving them. But then repentance is sort of willing something new to grow in the place of the old as well. It is in some ways yielding yourself to a new chapter, that you're not closed into this one thing that has always been there or that has come to encompass me by my sin, by my false narrative, by whatever. And that very much is what is eventually a point of separation between, as we see as this novel goes on, those who refuse to kind of move further up and further in, as you put it, into the real land, and those who do let go of something in order to move.
That's right.
Yeah. What do you think about this? Like this, the sort of narratives, the being locked into narratives and the use, the importance, the urgency of having to break them here.
Yeah. The importance of having to break. Yeah. It's each of the bright ones who encounter these ghosts aren't dismissive of the concerns that the ghosts have, but all they're trying to do is get the ghost to move beyond this one note, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the kind of classic example for me is the woman in, I think she's in chapter 11, Pam, the mother of Michael, who can't let go of her dead son. So her son dies before she does, and she spends, you know, 10 years in this kind of ritual of grief, locking her husband Dick and her daughter Muriel into this kind of this long-standing grief, you know. And her brother is the one who actually goes out to meet her. He's one of the bright ones, you know. He's made it to the mountain, and he assures her that if she can just love someone other than Michael, right, not even more than from the outset, all he is asking is to get out of this ritual of only focusing on one person, but instead to just love God, to let the little bit of love of God into your heart. And if this can kind of be blown, if this spark can be blown into a full flame of a love of God, to use another image from the book, if that can happen, she will actually get Michael back in a kind of purified way. In other words, so many of these options are not, you can't have that anymore. It's you can only have that in a purified form, and hell is continuing to be locked into the narrative without God, the desire without God. Yeah.
And like you're saying, the ghosts are they're understanding in some ways of of the predicament of the gray ghosty type people.
Yeah.
There is, you know, he's not saying there isn't love there. It's just it's been a paltry kind of love. It's been misdirected.
Right.
We actually want to release that love, allow it to become fully in flesh. But in order to do that, you have to let what you have had die.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's the hard thing is, and in some ways that's part of the meaning of the great divorce, is to separate from these paltry things, let them die. You have to let them go and they'll be returned to you.
Yes.
So maybe we should talk a little bit about the title itself and this dynamic of the great divorce, because there is clearly the divorce, the separation of heaven and hell. And that was there in this little excerpt I read from the preface. Like, you can't take little souvenirs from hell into heaven.
That's right.
You can't fit heaven into hell. They are separate in the end, right?
Yeah,
it's
either
reality or unreality. But there's also a way in which this great divorce is happening within each individual soul. It's the separation from not God and God. And if you accept God, you recover everything else. But if you try to hold on to everything else or to anything else, and do not embrace God for God's own sake, you lose it all.
That's right.
So yeah, any of your reflections on the divorce that is taking place here in different ways?
Yeah, I mean, you've said it so well. It's hard to follow up
I completed the point. Perfect. Yeah.
No,
so I guess what I'm asking, Josh, is how much do you like my thoughts on this point?
I'm happy to be a podcast guest and just continue to affirm.
Well, if you're going
to
keep coming in this room, that's what it's going to be about.
Yeah, no, you've said it well that, you know, like I said at the outset, Lewis is operating in a really Augustinian framework. Mm. So St. Augustine, and one of St. Augustine's great points or insights, which he gets from Plotinus, an earlier thinker, but one of Augustine's great insights is that evil is not something substantial opposed to God, right? We don't believe in a kind of dualism where you've got the evil power and the good power, and they're at kind of eternal odds with one another. Rather, Evil is the privation of the good, mm-hmm. the privatio boni, if you want to use Latin at a dinner party or something.
I didn't, right? But yeah. Thanks for that.
I got a classics degree and I have to make it work for me sometimes. So the privatio boni, the privation of the good. And so the divorce, right, is not one thing in place of another. The divorce is dropping the parasitical evil on the good, right? And then you get the good back, like you said. It's such an Augustinian point. It's really beautiful.
Love that.
Does your community need help measuring the heart of your religious education? Are you wondering if your community provides a sense of belonging for members? NCEA Rise is a family of comprehensive assessments designed to measure what your community knows and feels about the faith. But it doesn't stop there. Results can be used for instructional planning, professional development, community engagement, and more. NCEA provides meaningful network and resource support for its members. Find out more at NCEARISE at www.ncearise.org.
Hey, this is Leonard DiLorenzo. You're listening to Church Life Today. Joining me in the studio today is my friend and colleague, Josh McManaway. We're talking about C.S. Lewis's great little book, The Great Divorce. If you're interested in some more things having to do with Lewis and Tolkien and folks of their ilk, we've started a new project here in the McGrath Institute called the Inklings Project. You can find out about that at inklingsproject.org. All right. I know that one of your favorite episodes in this book has to do with this comical, tragic figure, the Episcopal ghost.
Yes.
Can you narrate this for us and tell us, you know, I think you know more about this than many of us do. Just tell us what's going on here and go wherever you like.
Yeah. So the Episcopal ghost is somebody who shows up in chapter 5. And the kind of bright person that he meets with is somebody that he knew in his former life. And they had clearly studied theology and seemed to have both held clerical rank. Certainly the Episcopal ghost was made a bishop in the Church of England. And Lewis sometimes likes to model his characters on people that were, you know, in his real life. So, you know, the guy who took care of the grounds at C.S. Lewis's house, the Kilns, was the model for Puddle Glum, the Marsh Wiggle.
Oh, man.
Just always very kind of sad and dour. And, oh, you know, it's a bright day out today. Well, it's going to be cloudy later, you know, one of those. And so the Episcopal ghost seems to have been modeled on this guy, E.W. Barnes, who lived from about 1874 to 1953. So he's a contemporary of Lewis's. He had originally studied mathematics at Cambridge and taught at Cambridge for a while, but entered into the Church of England as a cleric, left teaching mathematics, I think, around 1915, and started preaching against the deity of Christ, started preaching against the virgin birth. You know, these things no longer recommended themselves to his intellectual faculties. And so he had to ask the bold questions and then preach the bold sermons like the Episcopal ghost here. And in 1923, I found a homily that he preached in Westminster Abbey. No small church,
right,
against the deity of Christ.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was made Bishop of Birmingham in 1924, the year thereafter. And so Lewis is pretty incensed by this idea. But the ghost is this parody of an intellectual, that what he wants is always the questioning, but never the answer, always the traveling, but never the arrival. And so it's the exact opposite of faith seeking understanding. It's faith seeking for the sake of seeking, you know, and it is as unsubstantial as he is himself. And the guy that he meets with says, look here, like truth is here. You could have it. Even though this Episcopal ghost, this parody, you know, speaks in the lexicon of the Christian tradition, you know, we must all live by hope, and you know, we're all still looking for the kingdom. And when I was a child, I thought childish things, you know, but I put away childish things as when I became a man. And he even, you know, at the end of the scene, walks away humming City of God, how broad and far, you know. So he has all of the accoutrement of the Christian life and the religion, but believes none of it.
Mm.
You know, when pressed, does not even believe it, that God exists. And
it'd be interesting to discuss this.
It would be interesting to discuss this, right? So what does he opt for instead of God himself? He opts to go back to hell to give a paper in his theological circles, which is just such an academic thing to do.
You know? Right.
I couldn't have God myself. I need to go down and give a paper.
The paper is hysterical, by the way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we don't read the paper, but he gives us the topic of the paper.
That's right. Yeah. So he says he's meditating. He doesn't, he says he's meditating on Ephesians 4:13 is the line that he quotes, you know, growing into the full stature of Christ, which in Ephesians for Paul, Christ is the measure. Right.
But he is the full stature.
Yeah. He's the thing into which we are growing.
Seems pretty obvious.
Yes. But the Episcopal ghost says, you know, that the paper is going to consider what would have happened if Jesus had matured, that he was cut off too early. And what would some of his mature views have looked like?
The full measure of Christ.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Right. And no doubt, right, he would have broken with some of his earlier beliefs, you know, being so naive. But if he were an older man, of course, he would have believed something different. And the ghost has the audacity to say that in light of this paper, in light of considering Jesus' mature views, he says, one feels for the first time that the crucifixion was a tragedy.
because Christ lost his full, you know, full potential.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
If only he had lived up to his full potential.
Yes.
So the guy prefers his theological study circles and contemplating what could have been instead of the Christ that really is.
Oh my goodness. You know, and part of this, because we're laughing at it, because it's absurd and hysterical.
Yes.
And that's actually part of the way I think you're supposed to take this book is like you come across these scenes and they're some of them. It's like, why? What are you doing? Like, yes. Why would you do this? And it's funny. And that actually kind of puts you in the place, not of mocking. I suppose you could mock the ghostly figures, but it actually puts you in the place with the bright people, these saints who have returned. They are so willing and ready to laugh at the foolishness of these human errors, not just in their sister and their brother and their friend and their colleague, actually in themselves. Like, oh, I've laughed over all of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you have an example that you like in particular? Any of the vignettes?
About the laughing over it? Well, this wasn't the laughing over it, but I was thinking about in relation to what you were saying, the Episcopal ghost and then the artist later on. There's something connected here, right? This artist who is brought into the bright place, the great landscape, and he's overwhelmed by the beauty here. And here is the kind of landscape that he would love to capture in his art. And he cannot wait to start painting it, but he will not be permitted to paint. And, you know, he's frustrated by that. Why can't I paint? And he said, well, there's nothing. Why would you want to paint at this point? Like the first order of business is to absorb this, like to take in the beauty, drink of it, learn to see it better, enjoy it really.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, you know, I'll do that for a little while. Then how long do I have to do that before I can paint? And they said, well, if that's all you want, you'll never be able to paint.
Exactly.
Right. Because everything that you were seeking in your painting, even from the time when you started, when you were first caught by the wonder of light, which is what got you painting in the first place, you were reaching after the beauty that you're now immersed in. But he refuses to allow himself to make that transition to enjoy the beauty he was always seeking when he's confronted with it, because he wants to be the purveyor of beauty. He's become addicted to that habit of being the one praised for it, creating it, giving it to others, being critically acclaimed. And that, like, so to go back to what you were saying about Augustine, like that's the thing to break from. Like he's addicted to that. The painting is not the problem.
Right.
It's the seeking after acclaim or making beauty into something to serve you. His desire has gotten warped. So if he could, so to go back to this laughing, if he could not just, you know, disparage himself and like say all of my painting is actually terrible, but really what St. Thomas Aquinas is saying, compared to this, it's all straw, right?
Yes.
How humorous, lovely, and in some ways funny it is that I attempted in these little frames on this canvas to capture something so vast. Thank God for that talent and praise God that I can now pass beyond it. That's what he's called to do, but he can't do it. He's unwilling to do it.
That's right. Yeah. He's fallen in love. What does Lewis say? Something like you fall in love with the telling instead of the thing told.
You know?
And you become, I think you're right. You pointed this out that he becomes invested in being the teller.
Mm.
And so when he's told that you couldn't get, you know, 5 pence or whatever for one of his
paintings. His name's been forgotten at this point. He's insignificant as an artist
totally,
in the world. Right.
Right. And he loses it. And he says he's got to go back to hell and start a periodical and, you know, and get those neo-regionalists who have taken over. Right. Yeah. Well, if he cared about painting purely, then he'd be happy that others are painting and it would be fun, right? He's deeply invested in the self as the teller.
Yeah. And this, you know, Lewis, we're hearing it twice now, at least his sort of critique of this academic or cultured culture, right?
Yes.
Like the way in which it becomes a recycling system for self-praise, which is precisely overall in a very Augustinian way, the thing that must be broken so that you're free to praise the one due your praise,
yes,
and who will fill you with all light and beauty if you allow yourself to do that.
That's right.
So that's another thing here, I suppose, is like, this isn't, you know, one hearing about this book, having not read it, by the way, if you haven't read it, you read it in an afternoon or in a couple of evenings.
Yes.
It's very brief.
There's even a good version on Audible.
Oh yeah. In any event, like it could sound like, well, they're being, and this is sort of a popular opinion, a popular take on this sort of thing where you're being prevented from entering heaven. Like God wants something from you. You have to pay the price to get in. Except the price that's being paid here is actually allowing yourself to be filled with joy and to enjoy it.
Yeah.
God has no designs at having these incomplete, shadowy creatures. He wants them to be radiant and full, and will not allow them to settle for something less than everything that's intended for them.
Yes.
And so this is very much a part of Lewis's imaginary here, is that those who are in hell actually choose it. This isn't God's willing their damnation. It's God ratifying their choice, in some ways dignifying their freedom.
Sure.
By giving them what they actually chose over everything.
Yeah. Yeah, he has MacDonald say, in the end, there are two kinds of people, right? Those who say to God, your will be done, and those to whom God says, your will be done.
Right.
I think Lewis really understands the logic of salvation here. Because salvation is not kind of moving from one legal state to another unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as though, oh, you were guilty, God kind of waves a wand, now you're considered innocent, but you're the exact same person, untransformed, unreformed, you know? Instead, you know, he sees that we have to cooperate with God's grace in order to be the kinds of people who, when we arrived in heaven, would enjoy it.
Yes.
Because somebody who is unconverted could stand purely in the presence of God and it would feel like hell to them.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so he really understands that, like, this is an act of love. Like the intellect is involved, the will is involved, all these things are certainly involved, but ultimately it comes down to, can you get out of your own way and love God?
Do you know this sermon by John Henry Newman, Holiness Necessary for Future Blessedness?
No, I don't think I do.
So I'm going to read this little passage. So it's precisely the point you just made. And I've often thought of this sermon in connection with this book.
Okay.
And I wonder, I haven't done the research on this because, you know, I'm a systematic theologian. I don't do historical research like you do, but the potential of Newman's influence on Lewis on this precise point. So in this sermon that Newman preached earlier in his life, actually, Holiness Necessary for Future Blessedness, here's the real heart of it, these couple of lines. He says, holiness, or inward separation from the world, is necessary to our admission into heaven, because heaven, is not a place of happiness, except to the holy. And he goes on a little later, nay, I will venture to say more than this. It is fearful, but it is right to say it, that if we wish to imagine a punishment for an unholy, reprobate soul, we could perhaps not fancy a greater punishment than to summon it to heaven. Heaven would be hell to an irreligious man.
Yes.
So very much for Newman, as with Lewis, heaven is the reality. This is the real thing. God's presence is reality. God himself is reality. And so heaven becomes a place of joy for you to the extent that you are open to and welcoming of God. You've allowed yourself to be transformed and configured to his image in Christ. But if you are unwilling to do that, there could be no greater punishment than to be standing in that presence, because it is precisely not what you want. And you've been stuck on your own private preference up to this point, and you will not accept any other way.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. That's such a good point. Yeah. I have to go and read that sermon now.
It's a great little sermon. Holiness necessary for future blessedness. He also says, this is maybe the controversial point, if you will, of the sermon. He says, so what is heaven like? I shall say it is like a church. And you're like, oh, never mind. Right. But his point there is that, like, in a church, this isn't a place to bring forward your own private motives and agendas, right? It's not a place for scheming. You stand in the same direction and praise in the same direction.
That's right.
You confess together. You offer worship there, not directed back to yourself. You seek not to take advantage of your neighbor, but to accompany and join your neighbor on this pilgrimage towards God. So he's saying, you know, church worship rightly conceived and performed is itself, and I think this is the right point, is itself preparation for heaven. It's the sort of fitness and exercise for what heaven shall be, joined together in communion, seeking and receiving the love and praise of God.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So thinking about this, the transformations necessary to enjoy heaven, I brought this up with you before, Josh, and maybe we'll bring it up with others now. Like, the question of purgatory as applied to the great divorce. So when we're talking about this transformation necessary for this future blessedness, we see, you know, clearly in the landscape of the novel, the movement from the gray town into the greater real land. And then in the real land, the necessity of not just remaining in one place and running back, but actually moving forward more deeply, having guides to help you along, to strengthen you.
Yeah.
And being changed in the process. So I want to bring up, you know, the question of purgatory here in Lewis's imagination. He mentions, maybe I'll offer this first. Within the story itself, he does mention purgatory a couple of times. Because it's easy to see, I think, the gray town as hell.
That's right.
The real land as heaven. And then it's the question of the relationship between the two. So here's one place where he says this. I don't know the chapter. It's page 35 of my chapter 5. They're talking about discussing the gray town reverently, you know.
That's right.
Right? He said, discuss hell reverently. Reverently. I meant what I said. You have been in hell. He thought, you know, this is the talk to one of these ghosts. You have been in hell, though if you do not go back, you may call it purgatory. So yeah. Now the gray town, should you not go back, should you stay here, you may call it purgatory. And then again, this is on, for me, page 68. I'll tell you, I think that's chapter 9.
Yeah.
Which is
where George MacDonald.
Yeah. So this
up.
Is right. George MacDonald, who becomes the Virgil to Lewis. He is the guide.
That's right.
For Lewis. Right. Lewis says, the pilgrim, but I don't understand. Is judgment not final? Is there really a way out of hell into heaven? Because that's what this thing is, right? You've come out of the gray town and now you're into the bright land. And MacDonald responds, it depends on the way you're using the words. If they leave that gray town behind, it will not have been hell. To any that leaves it, it is purgatory. And perhaps you had better not call it this country heaven. Not deep heaven, you understand. Here he smiled at me. You can call it the valley of the shadow of life. And yet to those who stay here, it will have been heaven from the first. And you can call those sad streets in the town yonder the valley of the shadow of death. But to those who remain there, they will have been in hell even from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So he does place purgatory here, the relationship like between the gray town and the bright land. If you move out of the gray town, it becomes purgatory. If you stay there, it remains hell. I have a few thoughts on this. What do you think about this?
Yeah, it's important, I think, to keep in mind the preface where Lewis is saying, I'm not trying to give you an actual map of hell, purgatory, and heaven.
Yeah.
Right? He uses these vignettes and these images, like you pointed out at the beginning, in order to kind of teach us about the logic of purgatory, if not necessarily, you know, the full landscape. But I think another kind of something that comes to mind when I read this book is what Joseph says in Genesis 50, what you have intended for evil, God has intended for good.
Mm.
And I think I brought this up previously because it's one of my favorite verses, but he has MacDonald to say in chapter 9, yeah, that heaven works backwards. And will redeem the missteps if only one kind of repents. But also damnation works backwards, kind of tinging even relatively good things in one's earthly experience.
The whole thing was a tragedy.
That's right. The whole thing was an absolute tragedy. And so the end of the story is really the one that determines kind of the overall hue or the overall kind of vision of what a human life is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. What are your...
Yeah. I think I actually have often thought of this book as a profound meditation on purgatory, but not in those terms that are stated by Lewis there, yeah. Right? That this journey further up and further in the process of being changed or thickened, as he calls it in the book, that is a purgatorial journey. It's the journey of letting go of the corrupt, impartial, and misdirected loves. It's the journey of creating or allowing space to be created in you for a greater capacity for love. And even the senses are beginning to change here, right? Like the longer the pilgrim, Lewis, stays in the space and he starts to move with McDonald, he sees more color. He hears more sound.
Yes.
Right? His senses are being alive. It's the perfection of his senses. And so there is a capacitation for this freedom of joy.
Yeah.
And that, it seems to me very much, is the movement of purgatory, right? The capacitation for joy and the final severance, not just from sins, but from the effects, the lingering effects of sin, the lingering effect of the attachments.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very Dantean idea. Lewis, as a lifelong reader of Dante.
I think he taught himself Italian in order to be able to read Dante.
As you do.
Yeah.
Right. As you do. One of our colleagues in theology taught himself Italian once to date somebody. Going to date with somebody.
Mamma mia.
And, excellent. For fun. Hey, let me, why don't we make this conversation a little Ratzingerian?
Yeah, let's do it.
Shall we?
Yeah.
I'm just going to read this little bit on purgatory from Joseph Ratzinger's, little magisterial text, Eschatology.
Oh, yeah. So
towards the end, he says, purgatory is not, as Tertullian thought, some kind of supra-worldly concentration camp where man is forced to undergo punishment in a more or less arbitrary fashion, which is the way in which, many of us would, many people would conceive of purgatory. Rather, is it the inward, less necessary process of transformation in which a person becomes capable of Christ, capable of God, and that's capable of unity with the whole community of saints. And I think seen in that vein, we come to see, I think, part of the urgency of Lewis's story, which is that now is the time of the choice, right? Now is the time of moving and accepting the movement towards this purgation of allowing loves to be sorted out. And this is a very Christian belief, which is that life is the time of free determination. We make the decision about ourselves during the period of life. And the state of purgatory, and this is probably more of the Catholic view, is the completion of the ratification of that fundamental option, the fundamental option for or against. It's an either or in the end. And Lewis very much gets this in the text. He says it in the preface. It's going there all the way. It's an either or in the end. We like to smuggle in, well, I can have most of this and a little bit of that. And no. It's either this or that in the end. There's a great divorce.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
Yeah. He goes on. Let me read a little bit more from Ratzinger. He goes, and this is like the realism of this. He goes, simply to look at people with any degree of realism at all is to grasp the necessity of such a process, this process of purgation. It does not replace grace by works, but allows the former to achieve its full victory precisely as grace. What actually saves is the full ascent of faith. But in most of us, that basic option is buried under a great deal of wood, hay, and straw. Only with difficulty can it peer out from behind the latticework of an egoism we are powerless to pull down with our own hands, right? Yeah. And then he goes on to say, man is the recipient of divine grace or divine mercy, but we thwart this mercy and it's been, it needs to be released and allowed to become fully effective.
Yeah.
So,
and this is a good note, I think, that we thwart the mercy. These little vignettes that Lewis lets us see here, these kind of one-dimensional characters, and you had mentioned earlier, we can laugh at them. And we do laugh at them, but they're us.
Yes.
Right? We're the ones who do these things, who hang on to these lesser loves. And the logic of purgatory is helping us to shed these lesser loves in order that when we encounter the loving God, it's like, oh, you're the thing I was after.
Mm.
And then he says, yeah, and here's all that other stuff too. Everything that is real is heavenly. So, just kind of here you go.
Yeah.
Transformed.
Yeah. I think by the time folks as you're listening to this podcast, by the time you're listening, we may have made the move from Lent to Easter, mm-hmm. the time this is released. But that makes me think of these resurrection appearance narratives where something of this break takes place all the time, right?
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The one consistent motif in all the resurrection appearance narratives is that they do not recognize Jesus.
Yeah.
He's not hiding from them. It says, you know, in the Emmaus narrative that their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. It's something in them, not yeah. in him.
Yeah.
And then there's the shock, the break.
Yeah.
And that shock, that break in each case is the breaking from something, the letting go of something, like the whatever it is, the hesitation, the unwillingness, the inability to grasp in his glory as he is. And so we see, you know, what Lewis has sort of slowed down here and put into these little vignettes in that shock of glory in each of those mm. resurrection appearance narratives, which is that to receive Christ as he is will and does necessarily mean a death in ourselves of what we've held on to yeah. in place of him. And like you said, these vignettes are us. Like, we do that. This is in fact the bright people in the novel as well. They're the yeah. ones who have done this
yep.
and now have come back to help others do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just a thought there. Well, are there any other episodes you want to make sure that we touch on before we start wrapping this up?
Yeah, I think there are two things that I really like, and I can make them short, but we don't really see a lot of the ghosts transform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them give up and return back to hell. Some of them, you know, Lewis departs from them before the conversation is over. But we see one guy, the guy with the lizard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the lizard there is clearly meant to represent this guy's lust. And he is the one that we finally see transformed. And I think Lewis puts this in here in some sense because, especially in our kind of modern time, and I'm speaking certainly as somebody who teaches on a college campus,
yep.
but lust seems to be the kind of dominating, you know, the dominating sin for a lot of people. And I don't mean to take it lightly. It is, you know, it is a sin that plagues people. But we see a guy who is not that difficultly released from
yeah.
his sin. You know, he is given the option by the angel. Do you want me to kill it? He has to cooperate with God's grace in order to do this. And, you know, he tries to make some pretty weak excuses, but finally he relents, right? And the angel breaks the lizard's neck, but that's not the end of the story. The man is then, the ghost is transformed into one of the bright ones, but this lust is then transformed into a stallion that he's able to ride back. You know, this kind of glorified, you know, sexual appetite in the person, not misused, right? It's a gift given by God. And when used rightly, it's a beautiful thing, just like all of the gifts that God gives to people. The Episcopal ghost has his intellect, but his intellect was misused. And, you know, he's offered forgiveness for the misuse. And the intellect, no doubt, would have been glorified if he had only given it back over to God.
Mm.
So I love that Lewis makes a sin that maybe most people would have harped on and thought, oh, that guy's utterly lost. You know, he's a really terrible sinner. No, he's the one who actually transforms. And it's, you know, it's the mother who can't let go of her dead son, or the kind of grumbling woman who is becoming a grumble.
And doesn't MacDonald say to Lewis then about that, like, can you only imagine what that,
yes,
that love of the mother for her dead son would have become, or would become, if she would allow it to die and be
yes.
born?
That's right. Something like a greater angel and therefore a fiercer devil.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so the greater the gift, the greater the good, the worse its corruption tends to be in us. And if we would only give over these gifts, you get them back tenfold and glorified, which I think is beautiful. One of my favorite scenes that I'll mention, though, is in chapter 12 with this woman who comes down to meet her husband. And she's attended by all of these animals and this kind of retinue of people.
Sarah Smith, right?
Yeah. Right? Which, of course,
the girl down the street. Like,
yeah.
Literally, like, nobody.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just a very kind of plain name. And apologies to any Sarah Smiths who are listening.
right. We didn't mean that.
It's not a name like Beyonce. You know, like, you know exactly who that one person is.
Yeah.
And if I say Sarah Smith, you know, there are tons of people that this person could have been. And yet, in heaven, she's celebrated as a great, great person. And the way that she handles her former husband, somebody who likes to use pity to blackmail people, to hold love up to ransom with his pity. It strikes me that her love is so Trinitarian, the way George MacDonald describes it, that the Trinity is a perfectly satisfied, coherence of persons who love each other and have always loved each other for eternity perfectly. They don't need anything. Mm-hmm. The reason you and I and anybody else exists is not because the Trinity got bored with each other and thought, oh,
let's How about something else? Let's add a fourth. Yeah.
Right? No, out of a pure act of generosity, the Holy Trinity created everything that is and intends to reconcile it, intends to reconcile creation to God. And Sarah Smith's love, the way MacDonald describes it, that on earth, every boy and girl who met her became her son and daughter, but not in a possessive way, mm-hmm. not the way that we see these other people working, right?
They became better to their parents because right. of that. Yes.
Yes. And husbands who fell in love with her actually ended up loving their wives more.
Right.
It wasn't a way that took love away from these other people. Mm. It was like a microphone that amplified or something. Mm. I think that's exactly what the love of the Trinity does. This kind of self-sufficient plenitude of love that pours out into the rest of us and actually doesn't kind of take us away from these other loves, but amplifies them. So I love that scene so much. I feel very bad for the ghost holding on to the tragedian, play acting, desiring Sarah Smith to be miserable.
Yeah.
Right.
And sort of validate himself like this.
Yes.
This strange form. She's doing nothing but validating him.
Yes.
And yet he's trying to hold her hostage to his demands for validation.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's good that he's with the tragedian because this is one of the most tragic, I think, tales in the whole thing. I don't know. Do you have any ones that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I think, I should mention this before we go. This is, in the long discussion between MacDonald, well, long for this book.
Yeah.
Between MacDonald and Lewis, right? So MacDonald is now the one that's sort of he's opening up and unveiling some of the dynamics and mystery of what's taking place here for Lewis, for his understanding and therefore ours too. So here is this little encounter, or part of the encounter. I think this is still in chapter 9. It's actually right before that part that you mentioned before where, there are only two types of people, those who say, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, thy. So right before that, Lewis is writing, moved by a desire to change the subject, I asked why the solid people, since they were full of love, did not go down into hell to rescue the ghosts, right? Mm-hmm. Why were they content simply to meet them on the plain? One would have expected a more militant charity.
Great line.
Right. And MacDonald responds, you will understand that better perhaps before you go, said he. In the meantime, I must tell you, they have come further for the sake of the ghost than you can understand. Every one of us lives only to journey further and further into the mountains. Every one of us has interrupted that journey and retraced immeasurable distances to come down today on the mere chance of saving some ghost. It didn't bother me in the sense of like, I can't, get into this book now, but it did bother me in terms of like prodding me along to try to understand more deeply. This does seem like a strange dynamic in this book. It matters. It seems to matter absolutely that these ghosts who arrive in the real land are not unaccompanied. They're not left to journey on their own, which is what we might otherwise expect. Like you have to make your way along in heaven and choose to join the others. But what happens is, even though everything in this land is about journeying further up and further in, going up the mountain, that's where the fullness of joy is. Like, go, go, go. Yeah. These solid people, these bright people who have done that, come back.
Yeah.
And as MacDonald says, they've interrupted their journey. So my question was, what's the status of that interruption? Is that for the sake of, being able to tell this tale well with Christian accompaniment in the middle of it? Have they suspended their own journey towards joy for the sake of the other? And so in that way, they're, what does that mean? Are they not pursuing holiness in order to bring somebody else along? Or is this in some way mysteriously a part of their further journey into joy, which is to reach down, really, you could say, in mercy to bring the others along? And one of the things that came to my attention eventually in reading this is going back to the Divine Comedy and to the very beginning, Inferno 1 and 2. Dante, who's of course falling into the dark abyss of despair at that last possible moment when he cries out, mercy, the miserere me, have mercy on me. Mm. He sees just the faint figure of Virgil. Mm. And this is the image of Virgil and Virgil addressing him, Virgil, whose pen he so admired and adored, that is the first sort of link that holds Dante from falling into absolute despair. Hmm. But Dante, and we get this about him at the beginning, he won't move. Like sloth has overtaken him from the start. I learned this from the Dante scholar, George Corbett. Like he says, you know, I think Dante's first sin is actually sloth. He won't move up the hill. He even speaks that right at the beginning. And even after he's cried out for mercy and someone's appeared to him with another way, it's Virgil, who's not a bright person, right? He's actually in the antechambers of hell, but he's come here to Dante to bring him along. Dante still won't move. And so he's in danger of falling back into a deeper despair. In fact, worse, because he's rejected the offer of mercy. And you know what Virgil does is he says, well, let me tell you then why I came. And he says, up on high, there is a lady great who weeps for you. And he's speaking of the Blessed Mother, and the tears of the Blessed Mother who has seen your sorrow has called to herself St. Lucy, who's Dante's patron saint, the saint of light and vision. And Lucy, who has long been your patron, went and gathered the one who you've loved above all, Beatrice. And it says that she, this great lady, so these three great ladies in heaven, first, the Blessed Mother who weeps for you, second, Lucy, who takes you under her care, and third, Beatrice, whom you've loved before all others, they have acted on your behalf. And it is the third one, Beatrice, who came to the doorway of the dead, it says, and came to get me, Virgil, to come to you with the hope that there was still chance to save your soul. And so the entire movement of the Divine Comedy, and this is where I think it's so profound that Lewis was a lifelong reader of, of Dante, and as you said, taught himself Italian to read it. He saw there that Dante's pilgrimage began from its end with the tears of the Blessed Mother and with the charity of the saints reaching back to the pilgrim.
Yeah.
And so too here in his mini comedy, right, this Reader's Digest comedy, it is the mercy that flows through the saints from the Mother of Mercy who channels to us our Savior. It is that mercy that actually starts the pilgrimage in the first place. So that is something that, you know, from that little sort of spur or tack at this point, like, what is the status of that interruption? It actually had pulled me further into this contemplation of a deeper mystery of the charity of the saints, of the movement of mercy, of the reconfiguration of the whole body of Christ. And so that's something that I, you know, I've spent some time with.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to go back and read this book with that in my head now, thinking about that. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah,
cool. All right. Well, I think we've done our part on the Great Divorce here. We can probably come back to it some other time. But look, folks, if you listen to this, you know, for the last 45 or 50 minutes or whatever, and you haven't read The Great Divorce, obviously the next thing to do is to read The Great Divorce.
We have to.
Can't recommend it to you highly enough. If you have read it, we hope that our comments and reflections on it have helped to enrich your memory of it. Maybe you'll return to it. And like I said earlier, if you want to learn some more about some work that we're doing here in the McGrath Institute, actually with a whole bunch of other institutions and faculty at other institutions across the country on C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, some of the other Inklings, go ahead and visit this website, inklingsproject.org. The Inklings Project is a new project that we're involved with here at the McGrath Institute, working with faculty at different institutions who are teaching the Inklings in some way, either in their usually in their own native disciplines of philosophy or literature, or even in the sciences and business. So you can learn more about that there at inklingsproject.org. All right. Well, I'm going to have to leave the studio here in a minute. I think Josh is going to stay here and wait for the next podcast to take place and just
got a pillow and blanket. I'm ready to go.
Just wait whenever you get for back, whatever's whatever next. We'll talk about that. But anyways, thanks so much, Josh, for joining this conversation.
This has been awesome.
All right. And thanks to all of you for joining us on Church Life today.
Does your community need help measuring the heart of your religious education? Are you wondering if your community provides a sense of belonging for members? NCEA Rise is a family of comprehensive assessments designed to measure what your community knows and feels about the faith, but it doesn't stop there. Results can be used for instructional planning, professional development, community engagement, and more. NCEA provides meaningful network and resource support for its members. Find out more at NCEA Rise at www.ncearise.org.
Man. This has been a production of OSV Podcasts. To learn more, visit osvpodcasts.com.